Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable Supreme Court of Texas are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this Honorable Court.
Thank you. Please be seated. This morning, the court has three matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of their presentation, they are Henry Schein, Incorporated and Others versus Shelley E. Strombow, DDS and Others from Travis County. Walmart Stores versus Lizzie Reese from Madison County. And N. Ray Schweppe, LP and Others from Original Mandamus Proceeding. In each of these matters, the court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. The later or petitioner may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal. We will take a brief recess in between each argument and complete the arguments by noon. You may purchase a tape of any of these arguments for a nominal fee from the clerk of our court. The court is ready to hear argument in Schein versus Strombow from petitioners.
May it please the court, Mr. Hatchell will present argument for the petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, this is a class action certification case and there are two broad issues before the court. Does the court have jurisdiction of the case? Number two, is the trial court's certification order void because common issues do not predominate? I dreamed last night that I came to the podium.
Did you say, is it void?
It was an abuse of discretion.
There is a difference.
Big difference. But I dreamed last night as I was coming to the podium that a member of the court told me that I could assume that the court had determined it had jurisdiction and I could proceed to the merits. That may be a wild dream.
And it is. I'm going to ask you a question about that.
Sure.
And see what...
That's what I hoped would happen, Your Honor.
The response to your motion for rehearing by the plaintiffs says on page 2, quoting your original petition, this case presents four largely undecided questions important to class action litigation. And their statement is there can't be any conflicts if these questions are undecided to date. What's your response to that?
Well, I think, Your Honor, the interpretation of that, by the way, which was changed in the brief on the merits, and therefore it's not a judicial admission.
Well, but it's kind of hanging out there for you to talk about.
I think clearly what that means is, and we said largely undecided, but I think what we mean is largely undecided in a way that does not conflict with decisions of this court or other courts. It's not intended to say that there are no conflicts at all. I mean, we have briefed at least seven conflicts extensively within them.
Well, that gets me to our next thing. You've given us an oral argument exhibit with three double boxes. Do I understand by this exhibit that these are the three issues that you assert where the conflicts are and we don't have to look any further?
I do not contend that, Your Honor, but I am well aware that there has been, within the court's decisions, debates as to exactly how the court's conflict jurisdiction should be applied. We think that these three satisfy any construction of the court's conflict jurisdiction in the sense that they appear on the face of the opinion.
Well, that's what I get for your motion for rehearing, that we're only looking at facial conflicts or asserted facial conflicts.
These
we don't
are
have
the
to
one.
Be any more subtle than that to answer those three questions. Is that correct?
Correct. But we are not abandoning the other. But we do believe, upon analysis, that these three conflicts should satisfy all the court's various interpretations and the emphases they've given to the court's conflict jurisdiction. We think particularly, Your Honor, that the statement of the standard of review is of extreme importance to the jurisprudence of Texas because what Bernal brought to Texas jurisprudence was the rigorous analysis.
Well, didn't the Court of Appeals in this case actually apply a rigorous analysis?
It did not, Your Honor, apply a rigorous analysis at all. As a matter of fact, it utilized the standard that this court rejected.
Well, that its language appears in the case, but I think the Court of Appeals specifically said that it was conducting a rigorous analysis, and in fact, it appeared to really and truly hit on every single requirement we've talked about for certification.
Your Honor, pardon me, I didn't mean to cut you off, but pardon me, with respect, I must disagree with that. I will agree that the court facially states that it is applying a rigorous, or that the, actually it says that the trial court applied a rigorous analysis.
Well, if it facially states that, how can there be a facial conflict?
Because the application by the, because the rigorous analysis that we're talking about to this court is this court's appellate review standard, not the trial court's rigorous analysis. We're talking about the analytical structure that the appellate courts use to test whether or not the trial court did conduct a rigorous analysis and thereby abused its discretion. And if the court will note, every time the Court of Appeals comes to a critical juncture in this case where a rigorous analysis would require it to have identified the elements of a cause of action, list the common and individual issues, and then make a qualitative determination of where the litigation effort was, it retreats to the repudiated standard of presumptions and viewing the evidence most favorably. Most particularly, it concedes
that... Well, you agree that an abuse of discretion standard applies.
There's no question that an abuse of discretion standard applies, Your Honor, but...
Well, how would you apply the abuse of discretion standard in determining whether the trial court did a rigorous analysis and the Court of Appeals review of that? How would you then apply the abuse of discretion standard if you don't indulge some presumption in the trial court's rigorous analysis favor?
I think it is very tempting, Your Honor, to confuse the question of abuse of discretion with the tools by which you determine that there is an abuse of discretion. Just last week, I think the Fifth Circuit has probably answered your question about as good as can be answered. It said, we review the decision of a district court to certify a class for abuse of discretion. However, this discretion must be exercised within the framework of Rule 23. A district court must conduct a rigorous analysis of the Rule 23 prerequisites before certifying the class. Whether the district court applied the correct legal standard in reaching its decision on class certification is a legal question we review de novo. So,
well, but that, under Texas law, doesn't that mean that, and I'm quoting from Walker versus Packer, that in the second element where it's a question of the legal, whether the trial court properly applied the law to the facts, we say we give less deference to a trial court's application of the law to the facts because there is an abuse of discretion all right away if the trial court doesn't properly apply that.
Well, clearly, Your Honor.
And so we are applying a rule. We're not just looking at it for our own purposes. And there are more parameters than the Fifth Circuit indicated in that second analysis, I think.
Your Honor, I think that, again, in applying the rigorous analysis standard, or at least as the appellate court walks in the footsteps of the trial court, the rigorous analysis standard has essentially narrowed the field within which a trial court has the discretion to operate. And particularly, it eliminates matters of presumptions and viewing evidence in the light most favorable. And
well, but didn't we say that in the context of what's been stated over a number of years by courts of appeal, well, certify it now and worry later, and that therefore we'll just let this thing go back as it is, whether it was really all right or not, and that Bernal was saying that's not the way courts of appeal in this court are to look at what a trial court's done, and therefore it's a rigorous analysis that a trial court's supposed to make. And isn't the appellate court's function to determine whether that actually happened in the trial court.
Well, that may be one of the problems.
And did I understand you say that you think that the rigorous analysis is also part of the appellate review?
No. I'm saying that when this court walks in the shoes of the trial court to determine whether or not the rigorous analysis properly encompassed all the Rule 42 requirements, that that's an issue that is done de novo. And this is quite consistent with the origins of the term rigorous analysis in the Amchem decision. And the court, of course, quotes the Amchem decision because the Amchem decision specifically rejected the notion of a presumption. I'm sorry, it's not Amchem. It's the other case that's cited by the court, the racial discrimination case, where there was an across-the-board presumption that an allegation of racial discrimination made the particular plaintiff an adequate representative. And so this is where the rigorous analysis standard arises from. It is a rejection of that particular appellate review standard. And in this particular case, this misapplication of the standard of review and the application of a standard of review rejected by this court is quite material to the outcome, because the court concedes that there are individual damage questions.
Well, no, let me ask you about that. It's my understanding that the plaintiffs have said that they are not seeking consequential damages. Is that correct?
Your Honor, that is not correct at all. They have attempted, when they have determined on appeal, that they cannot defend this case because of the broad array of damages that they have alleged. They have attempted to do what they are calling, quote, judicial admissions.
Well, all right, if they stand up here today and say, we are not seeking consequential damages, does that change your analysis?
It might change my analysis to a limited extent. I'm not sure that it's as to perhaps some of the causes of action, but it does not eliminate the problems with this
matter. But that's the primary reason you're claiming separate trials are going to predominate. Is that right?
I think not, Your Honor. It is one of the reasons, yes.
What's your primary reason? I thought that was
There are actually three primary reasons. One, the influence of reliance. Two, the nature of the damage.
Isn't there an admission by someone with the company that says they all relied on the same written statements?
Oh, no, Your Honor. There's no such admission. There was a statement by someone from the company that they wished that people would rely upon their ads, but the ads alone are not the source of the misrepresentations. I mean, their reliance covers five causes of action in this case. And
what if the advertisements were the sole source of the misrepresentation?
Then you would have to move to the determination of whether or not the particular dentist who is claiming reliance upon that ad actually did rely upon that ad, number one. Number two, was the ad false? Number three, was it reasonable that they relied upon that? And four, what were the damages? But the fact of the matter is that this record shows very clearly that, at least among the class representatives, some never saw an ad. Some relied upon testimonials from colleagues. Some talked to salesmen over the phone. Some attended trade shows.
Let me ask you that. Do you think there is a difference between an oral misrepresentation and a written misrepresentation and something said at a trade show?
Well, if they're different, yes.
No, if they're all the same thing, and the one that comes to mind is the one that there's a finding of fact on, and that is, did they state that technical assistance, et cetera, would be furnished free and they charge for them, which the plaintiffs say was a misrepresentation?
I would agree if they're absolutely identical. There would not be a problem. The problem here is they have failed to prove.
Well, let's suppose they're not absolutely identical. Let's assume, for purposes of the rigorous analysis, that they're not absolutely identical, but the evidence tends to show they're similar. Does the Court of Appeals err in saying, in an abusive discretion standard, that the trial court didn't abuse its discretion in determining that that is eligible to be tried in a class action basis?
Yeah, and I think it depends here on the degree of dissimilarity, because that touches upon the reasonableness of reliance. And it also does not touch upon the question of where you have conversations, admitted conversations, in which you do not know what the representations are, such as at trade shows and in telephone calls.
But if we're arguing about the predominance on the class action, and that's what the evidence the plaintiff proffers, these are similar. Can an argument of the defendant, well, no, they're not, because we really don't know what the representations are, produce an abuse of discretion on the part of the trial judge who permits the class to go forward?
Yes, I think it is the burden of the plaintiffs initially to establish to lift themselves above those cases that individual, when the presence of individual reliance is almost always fatal to class.
But the argument is that they're all relying on similar representations, and that's the proof of the plaintiff. Can the defendant just simply say, well, we don't know what all those representations are, then justify a conclusion of an abuse of discretion on the part of the trial court?
Yes, I think
who finds from the evidence.
I think you can do that, and also let me point out, Your Honor, that when we're talking about the representations, just about free, unlimited technical support, we're talking about a small slice of this particular certification order, because you have got whole set of Windows class folks in which you don't know what the representations are. They're just claiming a defective product.
Can I follow up on that? I want to see what points of agreement we can have. Let's look at that slice. Let's say there were a class that was made up of only those who relied upon written representations and who were not seeking consequential damages.
And they're seeking what type of damage? They're seeking
benefit of their money back, disgorgement.
Disgorgement.
Yeah.
If you could demonstrate that there was sufficient certainty that a good number of the class, an acceptable number of the class, actually relied upon those, number one, and number two, that reliance was reasonable, and three, that reliance caused damage, I would agree that there would be the possibility to certify a class on that. But again, we're getting back into where we ended in Intertext versus Beeson, and that is sitting in an appellate court attempting to find somewhere within a class certification order that has eight causes of action.
No, I understand. You seem to have drawn such a broad line here that there could never be a DTPA class action, period, by definition, as you've drawn it. If reliance is an element of any cause of action, ipso facto, it cannot be a class action.
That is where, pretty much, Your Honor, the Fifth Circuit is. But I will...
But do we have to follow that?
I think that it's influential, Your Honor. Of course, you don't have to follow them. But I do think that Fifth Circuit decisions have been influential upon this court. But let me be... I want to be very candid to concede to you. I can construct a situation in which a class could be certified. If you had, for example, a class of all folks who are in this room, and let's say someone is selling a weight loss program, and an absolute falsehood is stated, and everyone in the room ponies up money and buys that program, and all they want is their money back. That is a possibility, but that is the exception rather than the rule.
A weight loss program?
It's an exception that you would be able to find a class where individual reliance did not defeat the predominance.
Any other questions?
You talked about the degree of similarity or dissimilarity of the representation. In a typical case, would a defendant be entitled to cross-examine witnesses on that degree and finding out whether or not the plaintiff actually relied on the representation?
Yes.
And isn't that why, isn't that your strongest argument for saying this can't really proceed as a class action? Because Bernal talks about the ability of the defendant to be able to defend himself in court.
Absolutely, Your Honor. He's certainly one of them.
I have another concern in this reliance. The checker bag suit is the one that you rely on for the conflict vis-a-vis reliance, no reliance.
Correct.
And so assuming that checker bag is right and it is required, and this Court of Appeals said it's not required, so you got a conflict of a legal theory.
Yes.
In how you submit it. But does that necessarily mean there's a conflict vis-a-vis the trial court's certification order? What's the connection there?
I don't know that there's any more connection there than there was between the holding the intermediate court opinion in Bernal conflicted with Moriel, which was ultimately not even the basis for this court's reversal. But so what we're looking here and right now is not the integrity of the certification order, but we're looking at this court's jurisdiction.
I understand that, and that's why I asked the question. How is the fact that they made statements contrary to what a factor of a DTPA claim is, how does it implicate that there's a conflict when Checkerbag is a totally different case, not a class action, and Shine is?
Well, because the absence of reliance is the key ingredient by which the Court of Appeals in this case avoided the analysis of most of the causes of action and most of the damages in this case. What it was faced with was five causes of action that had reliance as an element and a body of authority that said that individual reliance is almost always fatal to class certification. So how does it avoid that? It avoids that by eliminating reliance as an element.
But there's a finding of fact, as I read it, that says the misrepresentation, which you might be able to imply reliance, is the free help when it wasn't. And it seems to me that the trial court said that is a commonality of claims.
But the trial court also found that reliance was a, quote, common question as to both classes.
Well, if that's the question, that they said it was free and it wasn't, and everybody bought it, or you could infer from that they bought it for that reason, isn't that reliance, and can't you submit that way?
You can do that, yes.
Did they advertise that they would furnish these things free, and they didn't? Answer yes or no. And the second question is, if you said yes, do you find that when they bought it, they relied on that? And I think the jury might be able, but that's a merits question, not a conflicts question, isn't it?
Yes, but
or not a class question.
Well, it's a class question to this extent, Your Honor, because the DOS class has 10 versions of the software. In my review of the record, I can only find one version as to which, quote, free unlimited technical support was advertised. That's version 7. It is very clear that by versions 9 and 10, which are within the class, there are statements that you must either sign up for for technical support, and that technical support is not being, or otherwise technical support is going to be charged. So here again is, I think, a demonstration of how the element as applied to the particular facts of this case creates such a diversity that you have to look at it version by version, purchase by purchase, and office by office.
Oh, that gets me to the trial plan issue. Is it your view that there should be a separate statement, order, or whatever it might be, where the trial court delineates exactly how this whole thing's going to be tried? Or can it be within the framework of the certification order itself as a separate section? Or can it be inferred from findings of fact and conclusions of law that the trial court makes?
I don't think I have any problems with it being in the certification order itself. The inference, however, troubles me because what I see the trial plan doing is setting a framework for which the appellate courts review on a de novo basis.
They argue that you can see a framework based on the findings of fact and conclusions of law.
Well, Your Honor, it has to do with
proofs of claim can be filed, we can look at those kind of things, and so forth.
Well, Your Honor, that's a far cry from what a trial plan is under Bernal. A trial plan is an understanding of all of the claims, an understanding of all of the elements of the claims, a listing of the common and individual issues involved in those claims, and then a qualitative analysis by the trial court of where the litigation effort in resolving the individual versus the common claims falls. That is not done in this case.
Well, the defendants didn't request it either, in all fairness.
Your Honor, and in all fairness, I think we did. You must understand, and I'm sure you do, that at the time we were litigating this case, the concept of a, quote, trial plan by name did not exist because Bernal had not come out. But what did we do? We contested predominance throughout. We introduced into evidence all the laws on the unsolicited goods statutes of all 50 states. We introduced in evidence all of the DTPA statutes of all 50 states, and we implored the trial court at every opportunity that we could to identify individual questions. We requested findings.
To make the predominance assessment, you didn't ask that a trial plan be drawn up to see how the cases would be tried.
Not by that name, no. But we did request, and there is in the record, a request by us for findings of fact and conclusions of law, and the last, I think it's the last 4 to 5 paragraphs of that request, do request the court to make a listing of individual questions, which would at least have gone a long way in accomplishing what a trial plan is supposed to do, because it is the influence of the individual questions upon in a B4 class that is important.
But
so
really,
I say, yes, we did.
It seems to me that really what you're challenging is the trial court's assessment of predominance and commonality rather than their technical failure to draw up a trial plan.
On the merits, that is true, Your Honor, but it's the absence of a trial plan that we say is a conflict to give this court jurisdiction.
Well, and that's what I have a hard time with. If it's never requested and never dealt with by the trial court or discussed by the Court of Appeals, how it can be a conflict.
Your Honor, I would call your attention to a case that hasn't received much play in conflict jurisdiction. It's City of Houston versus Houston ISD. It's 443 South of a second 49, in which it's probably the shortest conflicts opinion on record, in which this court found that a conflict existed with one of its prior opinions in the words, quote, reversed and rendered. That was a temporary injunction appeal in which the trial court, which the Court of Appeals found that the temporary injunction had to be dissolved and it rendered judgment on the entire case. This court found a conflict with its prior decisions, holding that the proper remedy is not to reverse and render, but to simply dissolve the temporary injunction. So I say that under a case such as that, and other cases that this court has written, such as the Miller case and the Bland case, that it is the application of rules of law that can additionally create a conflict. And here what we have is we have a Court of Appeals applying a predominance analysis without a trial plan, which I view as a categorical imperative of Bernal. And I think that is a conflict clearly under the City of Houston case, clearly under the Miller case, clearly under the Bland case.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument.
May it please the court, Mr. Dunham and Mr. Longley will present argument to the respondents. Mr. Dunham will open with the first 15 minutes.
May it please the court. If I could start off with the petitioner's oral argument exhibit and go through these three boxes. The first box on the left is a quote from Bernal that omits some critical language from the sentence they're quoting from. And what they leave out are the words, and erred in favor of certification. That is crucial. The criticism of this court of the certify now, worry later approach is also reflected in a court of appeals erring in favor of certification. This court of appeals did not err in favor of certification. In fact, the court of appeals applied the abuse of discretion standard, which this court in Bernal expressly retained. The very holding in Bernal contains the words abuse of discretion. And in viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to the evidence and indulging presumptions in favor of the trial court's order, they did nothing more than set forth the classic abuse of discretion language that you see in all kinds of courts of appeal cases where the review is under an abuse of discretion standard. If you're reviewing an injunction, a divorce order, certification order, you see this language time and again. It's nothing more.
You agree, I guess, that it's not just that the language appears somewhere in the opinion, but that they actually do that. It's not just enough to say this is what we're going to do, then you have to actually do that. You agree with the petitioner about that?
That the Court of Appeals has to be true to its words.
Yes.
Yes.
And that's, if it says we're going to apply an abuse of discretion standard and then they don't, that would be a conflict if they were required to do so. Just saying so does not get you out of conflict.
I would agree with that. It takes more than lip service, and in this opinion, there's every indication they went through every claim. One of the questions indicated all claims are hit here. They're analyzed. Now, under the abuse of discretion standard, I think this is clear from Bernal, and it's clear from the U.S. Supreme Court Falcon case that Bernal quotes. The rigorous analysis requirement is on the trial court. The appellate court reviews under abuse of discretion whether or not this rigorous analysis by the trial court takes place. This Court of Appeals, I think, went further than it had to. They looked at the trial court certification order through a prism of rigorous analysis. And in doing so, they reviewed under the abuse of discretion standard whether a rigorous analysis had taken place and concluded, well justified, that it had. This trial court heard 5 days of evidence, received testimony from more than 20 witnesses. There were more than 180 exhibits. There is testimony from the person who created the software, the person who serviced the software, the person who reviewed all the marketing on the software. There were documents out of their files which indicated that the software sold to the class I represent had been released too soon without proper testing. All this came in to the trial court's consideration, and she received that evidence. And only after we demonstrated that these claims should be certified that she certified the class. The second box deals with the Court of Appeals footnote comment on DTPA and reliance. There's another footnote I'd ask you to look at, because it's a footnote in their briefing, and it contains an admission which contradicts this being a basis for jurisdiction. In their petition for review, footnote 4, the petitioners characterize this DTPA reliance footnote comment by the Court of Appeals as a mistake in reasoning. Now, as this court has held in the Coltrus case, as well as in Ford v. Sheldon, the conflict must be more than a conflict among the reasoning in two different courts. It must be in the actual holding. Yet, as they admit, this is nothing more than reasoning. And by looking at the Court of Appeals' opinion, that's clear what it is. The court is analyzing whether or not certification can be affirmed if reliance is going to be a significant issue or if it is not. That is simply reasoning, and it can't suffice for a conflict. Now, the last box in the Schein Court of Appeals' opinion, the court notes from the trial court's findings her discussion of how trial was likely to proceed. At the very end of her findings of fact, the trial court sets forth an area where she foresees the possibility of individual issues, the area of damages. And when she discusses how damage issues may be determined, without a doubt, she is talking about how trial is likely to proceed. And in Bernal, the trial plan is not used in Bernal. Those words do not appear. What does appear in Bernal is the statement that the trial court should indicate how trial is likely to proceed. This trial court did so in its order. They may not like what she says, may not like the format in which she says it. But when they make a point of error that there's an absence of a discussion of how a trial is likely to proceed, that's simply incorrect. It's in there. And at no time did they ever express the complaint they've expressed to this court, to the trial court, about how there is error somehow in the absence of a trial plan or regarding the discussion of how trial will proceed, how that might be somehow insufficient. And then when they filed their brief before the Court of Appeals, they did not list this trial plan argument in any of their issues for review.
Let me ask you, in the Court of Appeals opinion, they say that the trial court noted in its findings and conclusions that the damages can be efficiently determined through proof of claim forms, individual damage hearings, or other manageable means. If this is a large class, how do you manage the individual damage hearings without violating our jurisprudence that one jury has to hear the whole thing?
Well, I don't think this statement is in conflict with the fact that only one jury would be hearing it. I think the jury would stay impaneled and would hear all issues, including any individual damage hearings that would be necessary. But the first thing the trial court says as it addresses how damage issues would be determined is that it may be possible to determine damages from the defendant's own records. And this occurs after a 5-day hearing when there was much discussion about the defendant's records. At the trial court, they told the trial court they could look at their own records and could tell you who was using the software in a network environment, who's using it in some other environment. If they can do that, they can certainly tell you how
Mr.
much
Dunham,
each person
how do you respond to the question? Let me start over. As I understand your position, it is that this really is more in the essence of a contract breach. They bought a product that was represented to come with certain support, and it didn't. And so the Court of Appeals seems to look at it that way. But how do you respond to the question that was asked to Mr. Hatchell? But if your cause of action is really predicated on representation being the reason you bought it, wouldn't every member of the class necessarily have to be available to be cross-examined by the defense counsel as to whether this particular member relied on the representation in buying the product? How do you respond to that question?
In two ways, Your Honor. When the misrepresentations are uniform, and I'm going to address it as to the Windows class. They received uniformly defective software. We know that from the testimony of their employee who developed the software. Every piece of software that went to the people in the Windows class is 100% the same. Software is one of the rare products that would be that. The central code written into that code is a database. The database was deficient. We know that from the testimony of their employee who developed the software. Now,
let me stop there. Where my concern is, it seems to me for a product's liability claim, a defect in the product, it seems to me that is probably exactly what a class action ought to be for. But Texas permits this kind of DTPA kind of action that exists out there, what historically would have been sort of a products claim or a breach of contract, now puts it in the level of being some sort of misrepresentation. Is it possible that a class action is not available for DTPA claims for the very sense that the thing that makes it different than simply a claim for a defective product is that representation, that the notion that they've made a representation that the person who bought it saw or relied on to their detriment, that, which then makes the critical issue the representation and reliance as opposed to the defect in the product?
Let me link the defect to the misrepresentation, the uniform misrepresentation. Once again, I'm going to go to Mr. Wells' testimony since he's the man who made the software. His testimony is without a database that can serve as an engine to drive this software, it can't be practice management software. We're talking about products that don't conform to their very description. The description conveys a representation. What they did, in essence, was sell a toaster that couldn't toast an eraser that couldn't erase, or in the words of Mr. Wells, a car without an engine. You can't sell a car as a car without an engine because the engine is that fundamental to the car. So that's one way. When the product doesn't conform to its very description, everybody's going to be in the same place as class representative. They are going to be relying upon this product being what it is called. Without a database to drive this software, it cannot manage any practices. It's the database that allows the dentist to do the calendaring, to organize the patient history notes according to the patients.
And the damages are all the same as well?
The damages, Your Honor, will vary depending on what they pay for. There'll be mathematical determinations as to...
Only mathematical determinations, though. That's the only way the damages come into the case. There's no cross-examination of any of the plaintiffs on that point.
That's correct, Your Honor. And there was testimony from the expert, Dr. Brashear, that this software never should have been released on the market because of all the bugs and defects. In other words, it had no market value.
No consequential damages.
No consequential damages, Your Honor. That's correct.
Can you give up consequential damages on behalf of a mandatory class? I take it they'd be barred from, each individual member would be barred from ever claiming consequential damages.
To answer the question, you can. I think as part of the appellate process, there's inevitably going to be some narrowing of issues. And,
they'll be barred from making those claims. I mean, the whole class is giving up the claim.
That's correct.
Forever.
And consequential damages are not compatible with class actions. Therefore, we've been very clear in saying we're not pursuing them.
Why is the class method superior in this type of case? And I understand if you buy a toaster, it's a $20 purchase, and it doesn't make much sense to bring an individual DTPA claim, but you have protections of the DTPA, basically the attorney's fees when you went inside, that seem to protect consumers who are making a substantial purchase. That may have consequences.
Your Honor, it is superior for this reason. We're talking about 5,000 dentists in this Windows class. They paid no more than $10,000, and more like $5,000 to $8,000 for each software product sold to them. You know, what professional is going to spend $5,000 of their time trying to recover a $5,000 investment in defective software? And in Bernal, this court reaffirmed the value of class actions when you're talking about numerous class members who have paid small amounts, and they really have no leverage for relief unless the claims are aggregated.
So I guess our salaries haven't gone up enough that I can think of $5,000 to $8,000 on a claim. I mean, given what we originally thought of the DTPA as doing, being a simple mechanism for an aggrieved consumer.
It's also superior because we're talking about dentists who received exactly the same product. This is, it's just one of those rare instances where if you're in San Antonio, if you're in Amarillo, you receive 100% the same product, defective for the same reason, such that judgment as to this class representative will be binding on everybody in the class.
Again, it seems to me you've described product defect and warranty. Mr. Hatchell keeps hammering on the reliance element of the misrepresentation claims. Where you've got a claim for a warranty, where you've got a claim for a product defect, that's one factor, but when you kick in the misrepresentation as being the basis of the claim, do you necessarily kick yourselves out of the class action? Because, as the question was, if you're talking about reliance, you necessarily have to talk to everybody in the class about whether they relied on it.
I don't believe you do, Your Honor. And there's a line of cases that focus on uniform misrepresentations. The Dresser Industries case, the Texas Commerce versus Wood case, Gravel Movers, Adams v. Raven. And where the fraud claims arise out of uniform misrepresentations, I've described one to you where the product didn't even conform to its description. Second way we proved the uniform misrepresentations is through the national advertisements. The testimony at the hearing from Mr. Azzarelli, their director of sales, is that the company wants all the customers to rely on these advertisements, expects everybody to rely on these advertisements. And at one time, he acknowledges during his testimony that the ads we were looking at, there's nationwide reliance on those ads. But the evidence goes even further. Mr. McGee, the technician who serviced this software and over the years had to deal with all the Windows customers who bought it, testified that during his conversations with these Windows customers, everyone expressed the common complaint that the software had not lived up to the representations in the advertisements. You have a common core of documents here, the advertisements, proven by their employees. And when you have that, you don't need to talk to every individual in the class to be satisfied about reliance. When you have that rare situation, reliance as to the class representative is essentially reliance as to all. And the Court of Appeals got it right on that point when they said not every fraud claim will be appropriate for class action treatment. But this is not going to be fraud claim. Not when you have the employees who developed the product come forward and say, he knew it was defective, never should have been released, asked the company not to release it, and they released it anyway. The head technician agrees with that. Their representatives in North Carolina, Ms. Hathaway, in Indiana.
It's defective, but that doesn't prove that a representation was communicated to the purchaser of which he or she relied.
Well, Your Honor, with respect, I would disagree. If the representation goes to the very description of the product, which I think it does here, if you look at Mr. Wells' testimony, he talks about the uniform defect as the thing which makes this software what it is described to be. And secondly, when you have this is not a huge flaw claim, not when you have the employees who developed the product come forward and say, he knew it was defective, never should have been released, asked the company not to release it, and they released it anyway. The head technician agrees with that. Their representatives in North Carolina, Ms. Hathaway, in Indiana.
It's defective, but that doesn't prove that a representation was communicated to the purchaser of which he or she relied.
Well, Your Honor, with respect, I would disagree. If the representation goes to the very description of the product, which I think it does here. If you look at Mr. Wells' testimony, he talks about the uniform defect as the thing which makes this software what it is described to be. And secondly, when you have documents, common core documents, that their representatives say they want, expect everybody to rely upon, and the evidence goes further to put in that actually there was class-wide reliance on these documents. When that evidence comes in, I don't know how a court who is charged with a rigorous analysis under Bernal can ignore that evidence. To ignore it would be doing the opposite of a rigorous analysis. And this trial court concluded those claims.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court. I'm Joe Longley here on behalf of the 15,000 dentists in the DOS class, and the DOS class did not involve defective software. The DOS class, Justice Enoch, was solely a representation, identical representation made concerning the non-charging for pre-technical support and the invoice fraud that we claim with regard to the Unsolicited Goods Act, where invoices, identical invoices, you'll see them in the record at Plaintiff's Exhibits 131 through 135. These were identical invoices, which represented in each invoice that money was owed for software. These invoices, it's undisputed in the record, were sent unsolicited, and therefore our allegations are that that money should be disgorged with regard to the fact that the people who paid that that we have shown without any controversial evidence that they relied upon those invoices by their payment.
Is your class seeking consequential damages?
No, we're not.
I have a question about this. This is an opt-out class, right?
It's an opt-out class, and anyone who has consequential damages has the opportunity to opt out.
But then doesn't that have to be in the class definition, the disclaimer of consequential damages? How can anyone know when they get class notice that if they remain in the class, they're giving up consequential damages?
Well, it's stated in the class
it
notice.
It is? Okay.
Yes. That will be fully disclosed in the class notice that by staying in the class, certain things happen or may not happen, and certain things may happen or you may have eventual rights if you opt out.
Mr. Hatchell stated that there may be some doubt about whether you are or are not seeking consequential damages.
Well, with regard to the DOS class, we're not seeking consequential damages, and to my knowledge, never have. We're seeking disgorgement of the monies that the people paid in reliance upon invoice fraud.
Is the proposed class definition in the record?
It is in the record. You'll find it on the very front page of the findings of fact and conclusion.
And it does disclaim consequential damages.
It does not disclaim consequential damages. The DOS class is everyone who is in the DOS class versions 1 through and including 10.
Well, again, that gets me back to my original question. How is somebody going to know whether to opt in or out if they don't know that by staying in the class, they're not going to be seeking consequential damages?
That will be handled through the class notice that will go to those people in the DOS class, speaking only for it. The people who have the DOS class versions 1 through 10 will receive a class notice, which the disclosures will be made in that class notice with regard to whether what happens if they stay in, what happens if they choose to opt out, and consequential damages will be addressed in that.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
Well, I was going to say, Ms. Longley, you were cut short a little bit on your time. Was there any one particular point you wanted to make?
I would just like to reaffirm the fact that we have identical representations, identical reliance. It's all identical with regard to the DOS class, and that is the greater moving case, basically, which this court WOJ recently. And with regard to the conflicts, we again rely upon the recent case of Collins versus the Ison Newsom. There's no conflict with regard to the DOS class. In the Shine case with any other case under the definitions adopted by this court. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court. There are three very serious fundamental problems with the argument by Mr. Doan. His entire argument is premised upon the fact that there was a common misrepresentation as to the Windows plan, that there is one measure of damages, and that there is a single simple defect. All of those are false. But the thing that's most distressing to me today is the representation that this certification order does not certify actual special and consequential damages. Both pleadings by both parties use those terms. And in Bernal, the court says, first of all, in certifying a class, the court must be aware of what the pleadings say. In the court's findings, the court certifies whether or not members of both classes, quote, suffered damages. In the DOS class, one of the dentists who is purporting to be a class representative claims, quote, coercion in being made to buy technical support and claims mental anguish damages in the pleadings. And that is the problem. What you have heard today are two folks who have come to the notion that they cannot defend the class they got. And we're back right where we are, where we were in Intertext versus Beeson. When the plaintiffs could not sustain the class definition on what they got, so they wanted to Dow waiver clause. In this particular case, they now want to reduce 8 claims, 5 of which include reliance, only one of which includes a known representation. The Windows class doesn't even have an identifiable representation that we can find in any ad. And the notion that there is a single defect in the software is like certifying a class of Ford automobiles that have defects everywhere from bad wiper blades to exploding gas tanks. I guess the notion of the single defect raises the question, the age-old question, if a tree falls in the woods and there's nobody there to hear it, is there sound? If all their testimony is that all software has bugs, and if I use it on my particular in my particular environment and it doesn't cause a problem, is it defective? And in both classes, we have people who are using this software today. But the problem is, and the problem that they face is, they claim these consequential damages, which include both mental anguish and lost profits, but the effects of this so-called, quote, common defect range all the way from, oh, it was really hard to boot up, all the way down to it corrupts data. But it was really hard to boot up doesn't sound to me like a $74,000 claim.
What do you think our judgment should look like here?
I think your judgment should be that, number one, you have a conflict on the basis of any of the conflicts that we have, and two, that plaintiffs failed to sustain their burden of proving that the common issues predominate.
And there
would be, of course...
And therefore,
the class is ordered decertified and remanded to the trial court for proceedings not inconsistent with the opinion.
And at that point, they could then seek to certify a more narrow class.
They could, indeed. So I think where we are today, on the basis of the arguments that you have heard, is essentially a concession that this class cannot stand.
But this is not really a question of narrowing the class definition. It would be a question of going back and changing the pleadings with respect to the claims being made and the damages sought.
Oh, yes.
It's not a question of changing. You're not complaining about the class definition.
No.
You're claiming that the pleadings that will now form the basis of the class claims against the defendants make the class inappropriate, therefore the pleadings would need to be amended. And then the court could recertify the same class.
I'm not sure.
I know you're not ready to concede, and I'm not asking you for that. I misphrased that. But that would be the way it would work.
I suppose so, yes. Could do that. I'm not sure whether that would be consistent with the mandate of the court, but I think that what we have here is a class that must fall under the predominant standard on any one of my panels.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument of the first clause. We'll take a brief recess.
Yes, please.